Board Philosophy, the board game podcast where we talk about nothing serious, seriously. Each episode, we randomly pick from a list of niche, deep board game topics and have at it. So we invite you to join us at the table, listen in on our conversations, and let us know what you think.
Welcome to episode 27 of Cardboard Philosophy. This is very exciting because once again, I, Stephen, am hosting. But it is also our one-year anniversary,
wow.
I believe. It seems that if our math checks out, it will have been a year since the first one when this one arrives. So, exciting stuff.
Let's see. 26 times 2, so 2 carry the 1, 52. Let me Google how many weeks in a year. There's 52 weeks in a year. It's been a
whoa.
Year.
Yep. It's weird,
that's
but it works.
Almost 1 week for every card in a standard deck of cards.
That's why it's like that, you know? I talked to the guy who made the standard deck. That's what he told me. His name's Ryan.
Ryan Standard.
All right. As is tradition, let's roll the die. See what we're talking about. And 26. So this is... this is from Pete, our second guest?
Second guest of these little tiny towns.
And so the topic from Pete was implicit rules. How do games successfully reinforce rules through their graphic design, components, or other elements? For example, in Concordia, you increase your storage capacity by placing boats and colonists, which occupy spaces in your warehouse. Cool. We don't have Pete here to give us any more light, but I think that pretty much explains it. I think we know what that means.
Yeah, so if you haven't played Concordia, maybe I can try to paint a picture of the player board. So on your player board, you have a bunch of spaces to store goods. And at the start of the game, I think 4 or 6 of these are open and available. The other ones all have a person or a boat on them, so they're covering them up. And as soon as you put that person or that boat out onto the board, you now have an extra storage space. So it's an implicit rule in the sense that it doesn't say for every boat and person you have on the board, your storage capacity is increased by 1. That's not like an explicitly written thing you have to remember and track kind of manually and count up. Oh, I have my base 4 and then I have 3 out there, so it's 7. You can just see from the way the graphic design is done that I can hold 7 goods now because, of course, those warehouses are now open. So I think that's what he means with implicit rules.
I do really appreciate when games are able to do this, you know, and to me, it sometimes feels like I think it also can help like with the theme, like when things kind of click together. So there's a solo trick taker game called For Northwood. And in this game, you're kind of like playing cards against other cards from a deck. And then there's these characters that you're going around, they're like the rounds, like each round you kind of play a round of trick taking against this card, and then if you convince them to join your cause, then they are like on your side. And the way it works is there's a card that has the point value, and then there's the card that you put the character on, so you randomize it each game. But once you, if you successfully like negotiate or win the round, then you slide them down to cover the points. So it not only covers the point value, kind of letting you know, like you don't have to worry about that one anymore. But then at the top of the card, there's a little speech bubble that says For Northwood. And so now it looks like that character is kind of cheering along with you. And so it's just like this really clever way that just by sliding that card down, it kind of implies like you've beat the round, the number is cleared, and now they're on your side. Like it ties in thematically, it kind of like reinforces the rules, or like just how the game works, like the structure or the flow. So I always thought that was really clever and love when I see stuff like that in games.
I think what we're talking about is when the graphic design complements the gameplay in a really good way, because I'm also thinking of something like a Kanban, which has a similar mechanic to Concordia, where you have these little locks that are on your player board and you can't put stuff in those spaces until you get rid of the locks. But like the design of having a lock there is obviously fairly intuitive, but then the graphic design around that to indicate, oh, well, there's this shape that goes with everything else of that shape is going to go here once you get rid of the lock. It's one of those things that you can just kind of intuit without anyone actually teaching you the rules. You can kind of sit down, look at the board and go, once you have a bit of a breadcrumb trail of how the iconography works, take it from there.
Yeah, it's almost like when the graphic design starts to actually interact with the game mechanics, you know?
I'm even thinking of maybe more obvious implicit rules we're not thinking about. Like, for example, in a game where you put tiles on a grid, it is implicit that, like, you can't go off the grid. Like, most people just intuit that, right? But I could imagine a scenario where the graphic design is, like, done in such a way where it bleeds too much with the art and you don't know where the border is or something. Or maybe, like, thematically it does make sense to overlap the tiles. And so then it has to be a bit more of an explicit rule. They can't just rely on you to understand there's no overlapping or going off the edges. There's stuff like that, too, that we don't think about because it's so natural to us now. But maybe imagining somebody who's never played a modern board game before sitting down to play, like, I don't know, Through the Desert. It should be pretty clear to them that, like, you can't place here, you can place here. You don't have to go through every single individual scenario where you can and can't place certain things here and there.
Yeah, even something like, here's a whole board full of hexes. Like, you don't go around pointing to each individual hex. Like, you can put a piece here, you can put a piece here, you can put a piece here. It makes sense that one is like all the others, you know. But if there's like three of the hexes that are red colored, that kind of implies, maybe those are a little different than the other ones, you know.
Well, I'm even thinking of flourishes in design that can kind of take away some of that implicitness from the rules. Like if you're playing a train game and the mountains on the board cost more to build on, but you have streams that don't cost any different than like a plane, as a player sitting down to play that, you're looking at the board and you're saying, oh, well, if I have to pay $5 instead of $2 for the mountains, I'm probably going to have to pay something for the rivers. And that can be a little bit confusing.
What about something like, not visual, but like naming something? Like if I call this money, it kind of implies that I am going to spend it during the game. Uh-huh. Versus if I call something victory points, maybe you could potentially trade in your points for something, but that's not as common. And it's not like that would feel like a twist if I told you, oh, and these are your victory points, but you could choose to spend them during the game, you know?
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah, it's not even, you're right. It's not visual. It's just like lexicon, I guess, right? Like I think there's certain assumptions baked in when you call something money, or when you call something a resource, or when you call something points. Like if I hear points, I think, oh, the goal of the game is to get the most points. And if it's not that, then why are they called points? It's very strange for them to be called that. And another thing that I was thinking of is implicit goals as well. So in a game like Mlem or Rapido,
ding, ding.
Where the objective is kind of to get to the end in some sense. Both games are set up in a way where you intuit that. You see, like in Mlem, this long board, and you see a spaceship at the bottom, and you intuitively understand, oh, I need to get up. That's kind of the idea. We're trying to get up. Or in Rapido, you see the staircase and the spiral with numbered spaces 1 to 20. It's a race game. Of course it is. What else could this possibly be? Right? So implicit goals even. So it's not a rule, but you understand what you should be doing as a player just by looking at the board.
I will say that now that I've gotten to the point where I've bought a few like games from other countries and the rule books don't always come in English, and so it's usually easy enough to find them online or there's translating apps, but I really enjoy having a moment of not being able to read the rules and just like looking at all the cards and being like, how do I think this works? I think there's actually a game that like that is the game. It just has like a bunch of icons and you have to like figure out how the game is even meant to be played. Isn't that a thing?
Friedman Fries had the wonderful 504 or something like that, or just called 504. Where
I think it's called 504, Yeah,
it's just a book where you move the top half of the page, the middle half of the page, and the bottom half of the page, and those are the rules for the game. You are dumped with a bunch of different components, and all the rules will use those components in different ways, but you can basically randomize the game every time you play it.
Okay, yeah. I don't know if that's what I'm thinking of or something else, but I'm sure it's been done, but yeah. It is fun to just try to like intuit like, this card has a big trophy on it. I bet that's like a point or, things like that.
Something that you've both touched on is victory conditions. And in the case of like Mlem or Rapido, it's clearly a race or there is a definitive endpoint to the game. Something where like victory points are money. The person with the most money wins. I'm thinking of games where it's not as implicit for the victory condition or there's a lot of rules around that. Is that a failure on the designer's part? Is that potentially something that the graphic design could have covered for? To use your example, Steve, I'm thinking of something like Money, which is a Reinier Knizia card game, which is not readily available in North America, but is available in international markets. The copy I have is Chilean, and the copy I have does not have English rules. So trying to intuit how to score that game, which has a little bit of a wrinkle to it, is kind of weird, especially when you're looking at different components from a different version.
I don't think it's a failure. I think it just means the game is more abstract. I think what makes something easy to intuit is if you have an intuition built for it, because it also makes sense in real life, right? Like, that's your lived experience. And in real life, you don't lose $100 if you have less than $200. But in Money, you do.
Well.
So, yeah, I think it's just harder to intuit the more abstract a game is. Like, if you were given a Go board and the Go pieces,
yeah,
you could play 3 million games, right? Or more than that, infinite games, because it's abstract. But if you were given, you know, maybe some very thematic game, you could maybe even intuit like a few of the rules. Like, oh, these are ships, these are dice. The dice have little blasts on them. I must be rolling them to hit you, right? Or like these are like very clear planets and moons that we're traveling upon. So it just, it depends on how thematic the game is, I think. And I wouldn't call it a failure.
Yeah, chess is definitely an example of that, where if you showed someone a chessboard, they would have no idea that horses move sideways, because horses don't do that in real life.
What? They do in California. I don't know what horses are doing in Canada, but...
They're mostly ridden on by people in red coats with funny hats.
Mm. A lot about graphic design and intuition, but also I think components can give you intuition. Like, if you see cards, you expect to hold them in your hand. Mm-hmm. If you present the same game with tiles versus with cards, I would assume that the game with tiles, like, somehow they're laid out and it's public information, but the game with cards, I would assume, is private information. Mm-hmm. And often when you deal out a deck of cards and you say, that's your hand, people are like, okay, and they don't show them to anybody. They pick them up, they know what that means. It's my hand of cards. Mm-hmm. So components can also send signals.
We just said about, like, a Go board. I feel like you could at least, some people would probably guess, okay, there's black and white stones, so that maybe this is a two-player game. Maybe we each pick a color. Like, maybe not. Maybe if you've never played any game ever, but if you had played, like, checkers, you might at least sort of start to... But then you might set it up like a checkerboard or something. Or, you know, like, in, like, we might put the stones, like, in the gaps rather than on the intersections. You know what I mean? Like, but you might at least get a little bit. But yeah, it is a pretty abstract game.
I kind of think gaming on that intuition or habit can also make games a little bit more fun or a little bit more interesting. Especially in the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of games where it's like trick takers, but all the rules are reversed, or you can't reorganize your hand of cards, or your cards come in the left side and go out the right side. And that sort of stuff can be really difficult to internalize initially, because, you know, you're so used to holding cards facing you and you can kind of reorganize them as you want. But not being able to do that can almost add to the experience of the game, especially in the first couple of plays, because it feels so foreign and so against what you are normally doing. It's kind of breaking your brain, but because the rules aren't necessarily super intrusive and heavy, that kind of adds to the, I guess, joy of discovery of that game.
That's true. I think that's when people describe games as quirky. You know, for some people that's attractive. It's like, ooh, it's weird. I like weird games, so I'm gonna try this. And I think weird almost means non-intuitive in a sense.
And those games are almost a little bit more fun to teach, because as soon as you deal out the card, you say, "Wait, don't touch your pile of cards yet until I explain what to do with them." And that automatically makes people go, "Oh, why can't I touch my cards?"
Yeah. And then on the line of components, I'm thinking of like Viking Seesaw.
Ding.
A dexterity game from The Good Doctor, where you are stacking different shape and sized and weight objects on a boat. And it's a boat with two halves, right? Like a fulcrum and a lever or whatever. And one side is always up, one side is down. You know, maybe like a scale. You can think of it that way. And it's intuitive to be like, I place the thing.
Seesaw.
Or a seesaw. Thank you. How did I not realize? That's why it's... Wait a second. That's why it's called. Okay. And it's intuitive to understand that you're going to be placing the pieces on the side that is off the ground. Because if you put them on the side that's on the ground, what the heck is the game? Yeah. Like, it's almost intuitive to be like, oh, I have to make it not tip over. That's the whole game. Make it not tip over. And so I think that's another instance of components intuiting the rules. Or maybe even the other way. It's like, he thought about the seesaw game, and it's like, there's no option other than you place on the side above the ground. Like, what else could it be? The rule is so intuitive that you could understand the game just by looking at it.
So there's that implicit rule, but what I find interesting about that as an example is there is a tremendous amount of gray area in the rules for Viking Seesaw, because the pieces are weirdly shaped, they're different weights, they're going to do different stuff depending on what has happened before, and they'll fall off, and there's rules around what happens when something falls off, but then like something rolls onto further on the ship. And what I think is interesting about Viking Seesaw is the rules are there, and depending on who you're playing with, the implicity of those rules can shift depending on their life experience and their take on games.
Yeah, I kind of had that experience with that game, actually. I feel like the first or second... I want to say like the first time I tried it, there was something in the rules where like I read through, I'm like, yeah, that all makes sense, I get it. And then we started playing, and there was like weirdly more questions than I, and like people had these expectations about something like that. Like, what happens if it rolls down the ship? It doesn't fall off, but it's like further down, or it was something like that where I was like, oh, I hadn't even thought of that, and it doesn't say. And I kind of said like, oh, I think it would be this. And I feel like there was even like a little disagreement where they were like, oh, I would assume the other thing. And it was just like, well, I don't know. Like, we both just have different expectations. I mean, obviously we eventually just settled on one and moved on, but
I think that works in a game like Viking Seesaw because it's so quick and breezy. And that kind of adds to some of the fun of it, where it's like, oh man, I never expected that piece to do this. What do we do now? And then there's, okay, well, let's just do this. And you kind of hand wave it. And then the next game you play, something even more outlandish happens, and it's okay, no one thought this was going to happen. So it's kind of cool that there's enough wiggle room in the design space to have emergent implicit rules.
Robert, I know in playtests we've done with some of your games, like, you're very like, if somebody tries to do something and that wasn't the rule, you'll kind of be like, oh, actually, let's just do that. Like, maybe that makes more sense. Like, if that's what people expect, like, yeah, I will try to build rules around that, you know, like,
I was actually going to bring that up, as an example, like a very specific one. So in Shuffle and Swing, basically you use dice at different locations, and when the die is done, it goes to rest. And somebody, I think it was Danielle, I don't know if she's listening to this, but if she is, it was Danielle. She thought that you would pick up the die by moving over it. But the way that I had it set up is you just had to be next to it to pick it up. But she's like, well, I'm moving from this spot to that spot, so I'm moving over the die, so that feels like that's when I pick it up. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And it's, like, barely any different than how it currently is, but more intuitive, and I think even adds, like, a bit of flavor. And so that was the rule from then on, and it worked. It's not always true that the intuitive rule works, but, yeah, if the intuitive rule works, that should be priority. And often there's many moments where it's, like, these are both fairly equivalent, you know, like maybe they slightly change the game, but in a way that doesn't matter. Players will adapt and strategize around both in interesting ways. So it's just like, whatever is more intuitive, that should be the rule, right? To make it as easy to remember, as difficult to forget, and as obvious in play. Because I think the ideal, for me at least, and I think for designers we all like, is to let the rules get out of the way and just enjoy playing with each other. Mm-hmm. And that's what implicit rules do. They make you almost forget that it's a rule. That's kind of like the ideal rule, where you don't even realize it's a rule. You're just doing it because, of course, there's no other option. Yeah. It must be this way.
I want to say it was Sandy Peterson, but it might have been Eric Lang. It was someone who designed a Cthulhu-themed game.
They both would qualify.
Which I know, that really narrows it down. But basically, they said that when they are at a con and they are playing with other people and somebody else is teaching the game, they will not correct rules mistakes. Because they want to see what a normal experiences like, and they kind of want to see what flavor comes out of that experience. Because to your point, maybe it's going to be a more intuitive thing, or maybe it's going to be something they never even considered, and that's something that could influence further expansions or second editions, or even just that experience that they're having at that table. Even though the rule's wrong, as long as it's not like game-breakingly bad, why not just lean into it? That's what people feel is right. That's what people do.
I don't think anybody plays a game 100% correctly.
No. I don't think I've ever played a game 100% correctly.
I like when an artist kind of accepts that their art goes off into the world and then it does not really belong to them as much anymore. Like it, right. I mean, it kind of does the IP or whatever, but like, you know, legally, but it's, you know, it's your game now. You play it. Like, so it's.
Mm-hmm. Well, the more games you play, you do kind of start to hit a bit of a critical mass where something doesn't feel intuitive, and that can spurn you to go to the rule book and go, wait a second, this isn't right. It didn't feel right. Like, I've definitely had that happen where we're playing something and after round go, resources are way too loose in this. What's going on? And you look it up and go, oh, we were taking the resource instead of paying the resource. That makes sense. So I guess expectations within the genre can also kind of play into that intuitiveness and implicit rules.
Yes.
For sure. Been there. What about, I'm thinking of, I just recently picked up Turncoats and Pax Penning from Matilda Simonson. And I haven't played either one yet. I'm very excited to do so because both rule books seem very fascinating. And I can't think of a specific example, but I feel like there's a few places in both games where the rules are kind of like fuzzy intentionally. Like they kind of, and it's sort of like, it's up to you to decide how to do this. Like, they kind of like, or it might even be like a tiebreaker. Like, there's a couple places where it's just sort of like, here's how I think it should go. But like, you know, if you can't reach an agreement, it's kind of up to you. And like, especially because they're sort of like these political negotiating games, especially the PAX one. And it's kind of like just about these houses and allegiances and stuff. So I think at least one or two places in the rules where they like explicitly didn't clarify it 100%, and that kind of adds a little flavor almost. I think it's probably a very fine line to walk, but I'm also thinking about that a little bit.
Negotiation is an interesting one from an implicit rule standpoint, because I think a lot of confrontational games lend themselves to negotiation. And I always find it odd when a game I recently played that did this was Serenissima. Serenissima is like this trade route building game, and there's conflict, but there's a rule stated in the rules that you cannot trade money, you cannot trade victory points, you cannot trade ports, but you can negotiate whether or not someone's going to let you through. And I thought that was a really interesting handcuff to put on the players, because you're not, it feels like you want to be negotiating, and it feels like you want to be trading resources to give yourself rights of passage through areas. So when I taught it, I was like, yeah, you can just negotiate with whatever. And this could just be personal preference, but I felt like it was a really improved experience, because now instead of saying, well, you can negotiate with like future favors, there's actual skin in the game because victory points are coin. So that was an example of something I guess that is set in a genre that kind of implies that it's going to allow open negotiation, but then strictly forbids negotiation, which kind of goes against the implicitity of that rule.
Yeah, negotiations is interesting, because I feel like almost any game, like if you want it to be a negotiation game, you can start negotiating stuff.
Yeah. Going back to the naming discussion, is calling victory points anything other than victory points just shooting yourself in the foot? Because A, it's a little bit confusing. B, your table's just going to call it victory points no matter what. And see, it can be kind of hard to internalize if you have cards where it's like, get 7 KP. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the larger discussion about like getting a little too like thematic or fancy with what you call stuff. Like if it's just victory points and you try to call it some like outlandish, you know, that doesn't have, like, is not just a synonym, you know, like at all. Yeah. People are probably just gonna be like, okay, these are the monies, these are the victory points, ignore whatever the hell your card says.
Yeah, I think the biggest culprit on this one was Botoku of recent years.
Yes.
It's like supposed to be set like in the Studio Ghibli-ish kind of universe, and everything has a weird name, and none of it makes
proper
sense if you don't like turn it into like common parlance, like card deck. Like I think like even like draw and discard have different words. It's not draw and discard when it's like just drawing and discarding, stuff like this. So you can definitely take it too far, and that's almost like the, I don't want to say the opposite of implicit because that's explicit, but it's like, it's almost like it's so explicit that you need to like implicitize it somehow. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's so hard to wrap your head around that you need to like reword it for it to make sense.
Yeah.
So in the case of Bitoku, I think the problem is it's adding so many proper nouns that... And it's got some really obtuse rules. You have to have very implicit rules if you're going to put that many proper nouns into something, because otherwise you're just increasing the mental load and barrier of entry so much, because you have all these new bizarre rules for dice and cards that you have to internalize, and all these new words you have to internalize, where if it's just like, hey, you roll the dice, you put your worker out, that's easy to grok. And then you can say, well, you roll your... ancient totems and put your mystic messengers out on the board and you go from there.
Oh, we didn't talk about all those Euro games where you unlock bonuses, like the Terra Mystica thing, right? Or like, or Barrage has it too, where like when you put buildings on, you unlock stuff below your board, which is very similar to Concordia.
Mm-hmm.
But I think those fall into implicit rules where they aren't visible until you have triggered the thing that makes them active, and so it's just very natural to see that now they're active.
Yeah. And the inverse can be true, too, where you're covering stuff over on your board, and when you cover it over, you get that benefit.
All right, so for our little impromptu segment, we're going to do favorite implicit rule, like a specific rule, right? Am I got that?
Yeah. Mine is in Zuvatis. So.
Oh, no. Ding and mine is, too. We'll see if this is the same rule.
Okay, so I'm going to start explaining it and watch Evan's face to determine if it's the same rule.
Probably.
He just poker-faced. Okay, so in the game, you are advancing animals through various exhibits, and when you cross from one exhibit, he's already laughing. I'm just explaining the basics. And when you go from one exhibit to the next, there's a laurel token, which is like a victory point token, in between the two exhibits. And when you cross over it, you pick it up. But there is a zookeeper, which is like a token that moves around on top of these laurel tokens. And when you move using the zookeeper, the movement is free, but you don't get the laurel. And that's obvious because the zookeeper piece literally sits on the laurel and you don't see the laurel anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's intuitive to understand, I don't get it.
Because
mm-hmm. you don't even know what it is. So how could you even pick it up in the first place, right? So I think that's a really easy rule to explain, and that little zookeeper is such an important piece of the whole game that it's important for its implications to be intuitive.
Well, that was yours? Literally the rule I was going to choose, so great job there, Robert.
Wait, the zookeeper rule?
It was, yes.
Wow.
Thankfully, I come prepared with multiple quite often, and I do have a backup, and it's going to be from Pipeline. And it's not necessarily the easiest rule to explain, but it's the way the pipes work. So on Pipeline, you have three different colors of pipes, which correspond with three different colors of oil. And to refine the oil, you have to run it through X number of segments of pipes. But obviously, if you have a break in the color of that segment, then it doesn't work anymore because it's designed for a different type of oil. And each little segment counts as one tick. And quite often, you'll explain that rule and people will look at you like, wait, we're refining oil? But when you actually run through it, they go, oh, that makes total sense. Like, I got all these little ticks and I got these colors. Yeah, this is going to be easy. Now, obviously, depuzzling that can be very difficult and it can add to a lot of the flavor of the game. But I think the way that the graphic design is done and just kind of presented is really easy to kind of pick up once you have gone through one refinement and go, oh, I get it now. And then the slow realization of getting it kind of sinks over their face of, oh no, I'm screwed.
I think I have one. I feel like I'm going to think of so much, like I'm going to be thinking about it all day and then I'm going to have like a really good example come to me later. But for right now, what I'm thinking is Ethnos, the game. It's a great game. It's not super complicated, but to me, the rules sort of like piggyback off each other a little bit. Just the way that you have your hand of cards and you will play a set and they have to match kind of in the classic way that you assume card games will match, where they either have to all be the same thing or the same color. And so that kind of just makes sense, clicks pretty easy. And then you pick one to be like your leader and it's the one that's on the front of the stack. That makes sense. And then whatever that leader is, whatever color they are, that's where you can put your tokens. That kind of makes sense. It's the leader, you know, like, mm-hmm. And then they also, that's the ability you get to trigger, right? That all makes sense because that's the top card. And then you play those and then the rest of your hand goes into the pile of stuff that everybody else can get from. And so like, that's a little bit, maybe not odd or like you wouldn't expect the, like that might not be super intuitive, but I feel like in a lot of classic card games, there is like a discard pile that other people can draw from, or it's still not wildly outside the realm of like a, just a classic mm-hmm. card game. And so it has a lot of that going on where I think it makes it a very easy to teach, streamlined mm-hmm. board game, because just a lot of the rules kind of take what you already know from card games, but then also kind of reinforce each other the way like the leaders on top and stuff like that. All right. Well, it's been a year and we're still having these little meetups. So hopefully we'll keep doing it and you'll keep coming around. And you can leave us notes at cardboardphilosophypod@gmail.com. We're everywhere. We're on all the pod platforms. I always forget this part. But yeah, we'd love it if you kept listening. Thanks.
Robert, you've had a game to advertise the last 3 times we've done this. Surely you don't have more games to advertise this time.
Do I have more games?
You have a Veiled Fate expansion.
Oh, right. Okay. So, if you like Veiled Fate, which I do, and you know, you might also, I designed some expansions that are going to be on Kickstarter like a day before this episode goes live. They're going to be up on March 12th. So March 12th is a Tuesday, and I think this episode goes live on the 13th, but I could be a week off. But anyways, March 12th, Veiled Fate expansions. I made them. They're fun.
Hooray.
And then March 26th, with Bitewing, there is a trio of jazz games, 2 of which I made, 1 of which is a solid dinger. So I would check those out as well.
And be sure to join us in April when we reveal 17 more games Robert has designed and is getting published.
I will say I played at least 1 of the Veiled Fate modules early, and it was pretty fun. So,
non-biased review.
Play some games.